Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning, and welcome to The Show. On KJZZ 91.5 FM in Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, why a Valley Museum is facing controversy over changes to a traveling exhibition.
And a MacArthur Fellow on channeling the existential urgency of Homeric poetry.
But first, state lawmakers are debating whether public utilities should have protection from lawsuits if their wires cause a wildfire. The bill under consideration would require it to be proven by clear and convincing evidence that a utility's property caused a fire. Joining me now, as he does every Monday during the legislative session, to talk about what to expect this week at the state capitol is Howie Fisher of Capitol Media Services. Good morning, Howie.
Good morning. Another week in paradise here at the Capitol.
Another week in paradise indeed. So it sounds as though there might be some changes coming to this particular bill dealing with utilities and wildfires.
Exactly. I think this was essentially a dream of utilities to say, look, we don't want to wind up in a situation like Pacific Gas and Electric, which ended up actually having to file bankruptcy in California after their wires caused fires. First of all, you've got wires that sag during the heat, they touch the trees. You also have the question of whether somebody should have cut off the power to some of these lines, particularly these high voltage lines. So utilities came in and said, well, look, you know, normal lawsuits require what they call a preponderance of the evidence. Is it more likely than less that something is true? And they said, well, that's, you know, tell you what we're going to do. We will come up with our own plans to mitigate. And if we follow our plans, it takes clear and convincing evidence. Now, that's not quite the criminal standard of beyond a reasonable doubt, but it is much harder to prove.
Yeah.
They also wanted limits on what they call consequential damages. In other words, not just that we burn down your home, but that you have to have someplace else to live. You know, we also torched your car, and therefore you need to rent a car and things like that. And that proved, I think, a little too much for a couple of folks. The measure that's actually up for debate this afternoon in a Senate committee would go ahead and say, no, tell you what, yes, do your plans, find ways to prevent your wires from causing fires. We will give you some protections, but if you think you're getting the get-out-of-jail-free card, that's not going to happen.
Well, how much are they looking to scale back some of the protections for utilities?
Well, I think clear and convincing evidence is gone. I think there's no way they're going to say that because, again, it's hard to prove. You've got something else that's very important. Arizona has a provision in the Constitution under what they call Article 18, Section 6, which prohibits the legislature from limiting the ability of people to sue and collect for damages. Mm. So even assuming they could get that through, it is probably suspect because of the fact that you'd be telling people, well, yeah, yes, you were damaged by the utilities, but you can't prove it to this particular standard. The other thing that the opponents of the bill as it passed the House have going for them is it's not only supported by homeowners, but supported by insurance companies, because the insurance companies figure if the utilities are not responsible, if we can't get our damages back that we pay to our homeowners from utilities, we're on the hook for these damages.
Yeah.
And so you have this fight of the titans, you know, Arizona Public Service versus State Farm, if you will.
Right. So, Howie, there's another bill coming up in an appropriations committee tomorrow that would set aside $50 million to the Department of Public Safety for local border support. Is this something that is sort of a statement bill that Republicans and other supporters are generally hoping to get in the budget, or might this be something standalone?
Well, I think anything with money needs to go into the budget. You can't just take $50 million out, even if you have an $18 billion budget, and say, we're going to give this away. You're right. It's in some ways a statement showing we are supportive of the border. We're going to do more. You know, the voters passed this Border Protection Act last year, has the state taking an active role in border enforcement. And so here's where we show we care about our local police departments. We care about our sheriff's department. We care about the cost of incarcerating people. But again, it's got to be part of the larger budget, because remember, we not only have people trying to take money out of the budget in terms of spending it, we have people on the other end, like Senator Mesnard and Representative Olson, who want to cut the amount of money going into the budget with tax cuts.
Right.
Somewhere it's got to get fixed. The other problem they have, of course, is getting past Katie Hobbs. You know, the governor is not going to sign a budget she considers to be unbalanced. Now, she has higher priorities if within her mind in terms of what has to be funded, perhaps than Republicans do. So this is going to end up the thing that's going to keep us here at least another couple of weeks.
Well, Howie, very briefly, do you have a sense as to whether or not the governor thinks this $50 million should be in the budget?
I think she's willing to talk about it. I think she's willing to say, you know, we need to support our local law enforcement. It does plug in with her philosophy, which is we support border crime fighting. We do not support having the state take a role in immigration enforcement. And depending on the wording on it, she might be willing to do it. But again, I think the price tag is going to be the thing that's going to sink this. She said, let's show me an entire budget. Show me how this fits in. Show me how we're also funding the other stuff. I mean, this whole fight over developmental disabilities and whether we need $200 million there just to get through the end of this year. And that's where the rubber meets the road on this.
Right. All right. That is Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services keeping an eye on the Capitol for us as always. Howie, thank you.
You're welcome.
Scottsdale Museum of Contemporary Art is facing criticism for an exhibit, not necessarily for what's in it, but for what's not. The show is called There Are Other Skies, and the name itself has also become the subject of controversy. Originally called Transfeminisms when the exhibition was on display in London, the version at Scottsdale has a new name and does not include some of the pieces from the original. And one of the original co-curators of the exhibit is not happy about the changes. Lynn Trimble has written about this. She's an independent arts writer. This piece appeared in Southwest Contemporary. She says when the exhibit was on display in London, it was described as, quote, a major survey touring show that brings to light a multiplicity of urgent, pressing, and ongoing issues faced by women, queer, and trans people across the globe, end quote. But the focus of the Scottsdale version is described as, quote, a multiplicity of urgent, pressing, and ongoing topics faced by female-identifying people worldwide. Trimble joins me to talk about this. And Lynn, how different is what's on display at SMOCA than where it's been displayed elsewhere?
There are quite a few works that are similar. The majority of the works were brought over from, were also shown in London. However, there are several works that were shown in London that are not shown here. And of course, all the works in the show are significant, but the works that are not shown are significant pieces. So I think you lose something by not having those works included. To be fair, though, I should also note that SMOCA has added a couple of works. So you do get a different, in my opinion, it's just a different exhibition. Because it had sort of a different curatorial, process come in late in the game, and you've got some changes in artists, but you won't see, it's not a completely different exhibition show in terms of the artworks that people can see.
Was it always planned to be a little different in Scottsdale than it was in London?
What we know about the original plan in Scottsdale was conveyed through, early press materials. And those came from Mimosa House, which is the gallery in London that originated the show, and also initial press releases from SMOCA. Both of them indicated that the show in its entirety would be moved from London to Scottsdale. But that was not the case. There were changes made after that initial announcement.
And we should also point out that the name of the show itself is different, right?
Correct. The show was originally called Transfeminisms, trans meaning, across, broad, to suggest this broad way of looking at feminisms as a plurality, meaning different ways of looking at feminisms through time and space, geography, perspective. And it was changed in Scottsdale to There Are Other Skies, which is, I'm told, titled after an Emily Dickinson poem. So, yes, there are differences in terms of the title.
So what are folks with Scottsdale Arts saying about why some aspects, including the name, but also some of the works have changed, even from when it was first announced that this show would be coming here?
Great question. And I should note that there was also some other artists that they were hoping to bring in. They had an artist from Israel, an artist from China, some other artists that didn't end up coming to the Scottsdale show as was originally planned. Mm. what they're saying is the person who's been the spokesperson on this for SMOCA has been Gerd Vestemann, which you would expect. He's the head of Scottsdale Arts. And he has said, the word he uses often is pragmatism, right? These were pragmatic changes. They were driven by factors, you know, multifactorial decision-making, right? It was their curator left the museum in the fall as they were beginning to look at, you know, bringing them works over. They had, you know, different space and budget and time constraints that they were working with. And so it's all, from Scottsdale's perspective, it was of all a very practical bit of decision-making that not dissimilar from other types of changes that could happen during a curatorial process.
I guess having one of the curators leave is probably unforeseen, but like, it's not like SMOCA's space suddenly changed, right? Like they knew all that, like what kind of space they had and how much art they could fit into it when they first decided to take the show, right?
Correct. And the show is 3 years in the making. So it isn't, you know, it wasn't something that was thrown together very quickly. That's a great point. They do have five galleries. The original intent was to include all five galleries in this exhibition. One of them would have been a room, a folk, kind of a forum space where they would have had community groups come in and meet and done programming to support some of the themes in the exhibition. Including concerns for women, queer and trans artists. And instead they put it in three galleries. And I could note, having seen the exhibition on more than one occasion, that there are places in the, even in the three galleries where there is, are blank walls and space where more works could have been included.
I want to read a quote to you that you include in your story about this from one of the co-curators of this exhibit who says, "The exhibition was violently edited in Scottsdale." That seems like pretty strong language.
It is, and that's by from Daria Kahn, and she is the founder and curator of Mimosa House, the London Gallery. And I think that, you know, with all the work that this was a process by four curators, three assistant curators, and then close to a dozen global advisors who recommended artists to be included. And my sense from talking with her is that there was a specific curatorial process, a long-term process, and it was very jarring for that to be changed. You know, whatever the reasons that she felt like the integrity of that process wasn't honored, that once one of the four co-curators of Transfeminisms, Jennifer McCabe, left her position as director and co-curator, or excuse me, chief curator at SMOCA, that that curatorial team, the original Transfeminism team, lost their voice in putting the exhibition together. And her words for describing that are that it was violently edited. So they have concerns about both the content of the SMOCA show, but also, I think more so, the curatorial process.
How common or uncommon is it for this kind of thing to happen, that as an exhibition travels from one museum to another, that things about it change?
Well, I think curators I've spoken to will tell you it's not that uncommon. But in, you know, in this case, the intent was to, you know, basically pack up the show in London and bring it over here. Mm-hmm. And in fact, they secured funding from three major funders to do just that. So on the one hand, in general, it's not unusual, but that wasn't the intent of the you know, the original curatorial team that put this together.
Well, the timing of this is very interesting because it's happening at around the same time the Scottsdale City Council has done away with funding, quote unquote, DEI programs. I wonder if any of the people with whom you spoke cited that as a potential reason for why this exhibition, any aspect of it that's changed, maybe has changed.
We didn't talk to anyone who expressed a direct connection between Scottsdale City actions and the changes to the exhibition. And in fact, the head of Scottsdale Arts has indicated in our reporting, stated that that was not related. And that would be my expectation, given that this exhibit was put together before, long before the city council made that decision. I think where that the DEI decision on Scottsdale's part maybe intersects most with what happened with this exhibition is it just feels like a missed opportunity that you've got this city council decision nixing some DEI programs and funding. And then you had a museum that was planning to have a forum space where dialogues about just that issue, right? DEI would have been very relevant. And this is an opportunity where a museum could have been part of raising that dialogue, of creating a space, a safe space for that dialogue. But instead, that element was pulled back.
All right. That is freelance arts writer Lynn Trimble. Lynn, nice to talk to you. Thank you.
As well. Thank you.
We also reached out to Scottsdale Arts for comment on the story. We hope to bring you a conversation with them, and you are listening to the show. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, a renewed translation of an ancient Greek classic.
But first, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders and New York Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez brought their fighting oligarchy tour to Tempe last week. It was part of a regional swing, which also included stops in North Las Vegas and Denver. During the event, Sanders and Ocasio-Cortez generally focus on economic inequality and criticize Republican policies. But one of our next guests argues if the pair wants to fight the oligarchy, they should start closer to home. Phil Boas is an editorial columnist for the Arizona Republic. In a recent piece, he argues it's the Democrats who are the party of the oligarchy. He joins me to talk about that along with Elvia Diaz, editorial page editor of the Republic. And Phil, let me start with you. I don't want to put words in your mouth, so please correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like you're calling out a little bit of hypocrisy here.
Oh, not a little bit of hypocrisy, a lot of hypocrisy for the Democrats to be coming into town like this and to be decrying oligarchy. Let's just say it's a little bit like Bernie Madoff calling the Kardashians greedy. I mean, it's just a joke. And the Democrats have been living off the largesse of rich and powerful people in this country. They enjoyed billions and billions of dollars of support in the last presidential election, outspending the Republicans by 2-1. They burned through $1.5 billion in 15 weeks. This is the Kamala Harris campaign. I mean, this is a party that is hobnobbing with the rich and famous all the time, and it is at their beckoning call all the time. And so for them to come into town and then to decry the Republicans like this is just laughable.
Phil, I wonder if you draw a distinction between Democrats as a whole and maybe these two particular messengers, Bernie Sanders and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, because I think you could probably make an argument that, yes, while the Democratic Party was, you know, having a lot of success with very wealthy donors, these two in particular have maybe been a little bit on this message for a while now.
Well, they've been on this message while they've lived large off of the Democratic Party and have represented the party. Bernie Sanders has run twice now, trying to be the head of the ticket for the Democratic Party. It's a little bit like Claude Rains, the French police captain in Casablanca, saying he's shocked to find out that gambling is going on in this establishment. You know, it's a joke. And you begin with your own party. If you're going to decry oligarchy, let's start with the Democrats and really go after them.
Elvia, I want to get your take on this. Do you see hypocrisy in a pair of members of the Democratic Party, or at least, you know, two who caucus with the Democrats, calling out oligarchy on the part of Republicans?
Well, you know, both parties do it, and they have done it. I think there's a huge difference between the donors. It is impossible to argue against it. It is true that the Democrats have relied on big donors just as much as the Republicans have. So, of course, they rely on that. But there is a huge difference between the donors that contributing to the parties and individual campaigns and those of the people running the government. I think oligarchy in this case, what they're saying is that the Trump administration, it is composed of billionaires, the people in the cabinet members, those running the government. I mean, you have Elon Musk, who is the wealthiest person on earth right now. He's the one in charge, unelected, by the way. He's the one in charge of dismantling the federal bureaucracy. So that's, I think that's what they mean with fighting oligarchy, the actual administration. And they are, both of them, Bernie Sanders and Representative Ocasio-Cortez, what they're doing is trying to fill a leadership vacuum from the Democrats. You know, people are angry, people are afraid, and no one is fighting back. And they want someone or a group of people or the Democrats to fight back Donald Trump. So that's what they're trying to do. I mean, if the slogan is not perfect, okay. I mean, I give you that, you know, slogans are slogans, but it wasn't just Tempe. I mean, thousands of people are showing up to these rallies. And to me, it shows that people are hungry for leadership.
Elvie, I want to ask you about that point you're making, the difference that you're making between the donors and people running the government. I wonder if in some ways in the current era, that might be somewhat of a distinction without a difference, because, you know, there's sort of a, even if it's sort of a wink and nod kind of acknowledgement that, hey, if I give you, candidate, a lot of money, you're going to do what I want you to do. Like, you kind of owe me something.
That's a huge problem in politics and has been for a long time. And that's why there has been a lot of fights and a lot of discussion about taking money out of politics. But because that is impossible to do, at least right now. And, you know, Bernie Sanders himself, you know, he has a few million dollars, but nothing like a billionaire. And again, I think people are just hungry to connect with someone, and they are connecting. I think Phil would agree that they are connecting with at least a segment of the population. And tell me, where are the other Democrats? You know, we don't like the word fighting oligarchy, which, you know, I may not like it as well. Where are the other Democrats connecting with the American people? And the Democrats in Congress have no power right now. That's understandable. They can't do anything to stop Donald Trump. And therefore, speaking out, going out, listening to people, talking to people is what they can do. And that's what Bernie Sanders and Ocasio-Cortez is doing. So I'll say they're doing a lot more than what others are.
Phil, I wonder if all of this talk about oligarchy and the, you know, the bank accounts of people donating to campaigns and running the government now, does all this in your mind point to maybe the influence of money in politics? Maybe the fact that there's too much money in politics generally?
Well, I think no doubt. I mean, I think the critique is legitimate that there's too many wealthy donors who have influence over the government in this country. But it's very hard to rein in, as John McCain learned when he was a U.S. senator. It's very hard to limit speech in that way, and the Supreme Court views that spending as speech. And so, until you get that change, or you find a way to regulate it, we're going to have it in our politics. The problem the Democrats have is that all those billionaires they have lined up on their side who contribute their millions to the Democratic Party, they're not altruists. They expect something for their spending and they get it. And I also would remind the Democrats that Elon Musk used to be their oligarch and they were happy as could be with him when he was theirs. Now that he's on the Republican side, you know, they're lighting their hair on fire. So, I mean, this is a problem of both parties. And if you're going to critique it, you have to come on like hellfire to both parties for doing it. And especially the Democrats, because the Democrats right now are the champs of oligarchy.
All right, we'll have to leave it there. Elvia Diaz, editorial page editor for the Arizona Republic. Phil Boas, editorial columnist for the Republic. Guys, thanks so much for the conversation. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
With tensions between the U.S. and Canada at an all-time high, there's been yet another surprising plot twist north of the border. Joining me now via Skype to discuss that, as well as the latest news from around the globe, is the BBC's Jonathan Frewin. Jonathan, Canada's newly sworn-in Prime Minister, Mark Carney, has just called an election for April 28th. What are the dynamics we should focus on in this very rapid campaign?
Well, with Canada's businesses reeling from a trade dispute with your neck of the woods in the United States, Mark Carney, a former two-time central banker for the Bank of Canada and the Bank of England, will be pitching himself as the candidate best equipped to take on Donald Trump. The 60-year-old political newcomer just took over as Liberal Party leader earlier this month after former Prime Minister Justin Trudeau stepped down from his 9-year stint. Prior to Justin Trudeau announcing his resignation, the opposition Conservatives were enjoying a 20-point opinion polling lead, but that's seen a dramatic turnaround, with the Liberals now enjoying a small lead of their own, and pollsters suggesting Mark Carney could even win an outright majority.
That is a pretty intense swing. Who is Mark Carney's main rival?
Well, that's the Conservative leader, Pierre Poilievre, and he's aged 45, so quite a bit younger than Mark Carney. But even at age 20, he had a roadmap for Canada, laying out a low-tax, small government vision for the country in an essay contest on what he would do as prime minister. He's seen as a populist figure, and until the recent ructions with the United States, it looked likely that he was going to topple the Canadian government at the next election. Now, Canadians have been frustrated with a sluggish economy and a housing affordability crisis. Mr. Poilievre sees himself as offering an alternative to what he had been labelling Justin Trudeau's authoritarian socialism. Pierre Poilievre won a seat in Ottawa in 2004 at the age of just 25, and he's held that seat ever since. So he's pretty much a lifelong politician. He's been leader of the Conservatives since 2022 and has previously targeted Justin Trudeau with sort of biting remarks, not unlike his neighbour to the south, Donald Trump. He was landed in trouble last April when he called the Prime Minister a wacko. That led to a temporary expulsion from the House of Commons. But his combative style has also been divisive, and he's been criticised for oversimplifying complex issues for political gain. And as I said, while he had been riding high, in some ways emulating Donald Trump, the questions of sovereignty that arise from Mr. Trump's desire to see Canada become the 51st state have become leading to a significant decline in his popularity. So I think it's going to be an interesting few weeks ahead for Canada.
Yeah, that's a very complex political dynamic to keep an eye on.
Indeed.
Let's move south, Jonathan. Brazil's Supreme Court is meeting tomorrow to decide whether former President Jair Bolsonaro should face trial on charges of orchestrating an attempted coup. What is the background on this?
Well, according to prosecutors, the alleged plot aimed to prevent Jair Bolsonaro's successor in office, President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, from taking office and included a plan to poison Lula. Jair Bolsonaro denies any wrongdoing and says he's the victim of a political witch hunt. In a sign of how divided Brazil remains, 2.5 years after the bitterly fought presidential election, when the charges were first brought last month, critics of Mr. Bolsonaro celebrated the news, saying the former president belongs in jail, while his supporters insisted that he's innocent. The focus is now on Supreme Court Justice Alexandre de Moraes and a panel of others who will have to weigh up the merits of the accusations made by the chief prosecutor and decide whether the case should proceed to the trial stage. The prosecutor's charges are based on a police investigation into the events leading up to January the 8th, 2023, when Bolsonaro supporters stormed government buildings in the capital, Brasilia. Parts of the buildings were ransacked and police arrested 1,500 people. Jair Bolsonaro was in the United States at the time and has always denied any links to the rioters, but the prosecutor's report alleges that he started sowing doubts about Brazil's voting system as early as July 2021, which are thought to have encouraged those storming Congress.
Well, some familiar dynamics at play there for those of us here in the United States. I understand Mr. Bolsonaro has been trying to get judges removed from the panel deciding on whether to proceed with this trial, right?
Yeah, that's right. Among the three judges whose recusal was sought by Jair Bolsonaro's defense team was Alexandre de Moraes, who has led multiple investigations into the former president. The lawyers had been arguing that Moraes' presence on the bench constituted a conflict of interest because the alleged plot to overthrow Lula included a plan to assassinate the justice, as well as Lula and his vice president. They also argued that Justices Flavio Dino, a former justice minister under Lula, and Cristiano Zanin, Lula's former lawyer, should also be recused. But the Supreme Court has now rejected that bid, and the hearing will proceed as planned tomorrow with no changes to the panel. And if convicted, Jair Bolsonaro could face up to 40 years in jail.
Well, finally, Jonathan, speaking of government upheavals, later this week, the UN Security Council is meeting to discuss the crisis in the Democratic Republic of Congo. This comes after, what, about 2 months of escalating conflict?
That's right. A conflict in the country has been stepped up since January after peace talks being brokered by Angola broke down in December. So the so-called M23 rebels renewed an offensive, which it's thought has now left at least 7,000 people dead since the beginning of the year. The DRC accuses Rwanda of arming the M23 and sending troops to support the rebels in the conflict. Despite assertions from both the United Nations and the United States, Rwanda has denied supporting the M23. Now, following the collapse of those peace talks, the M23 rebels have been advancing swiftly, taking control of two key cities, Goma and Bukavu, in the past 2 months.
And there was something of a breakthrough in these talks last week, right?
To some extent, yes. The DRC's president, Felix Tshisekedi, and his Rwandan counterpart, Paul Kagame, called for an immediate ceasefire in the east of the DRC after having direct talks in Qatar. Now, it's the first time the two leaders had met since the conflict stepped up back in January. And the fact the meeting happened at all took many observers by surprise. Meanwhile, the DRC appears to be turning to the US in its latest efforts to find an ally in its fight against the advancing rebels, recognizing the Donald Trump White House is interested in transactional relationships, and in the wake of the proposed US-Ukraine mineral deal, the DRC government is hoping to strike its own agreement with Washington, possibly giving the US access to Congolese minerals in exchange for some sort of security assistance. The DRC is estimated to have $24 trillion worth of untapped resources, including cobalt, gold, and copper. Now, cobalt has defense and aerospace applications and is also essential for batteries and electric vehicles. It's not clear, of course, what sort of appetite there'd be in the US for such an proposal. And in the meantime, it looks like this conflict still has quite a way to run.
Well, it'll be fascinating to watch the developments in that burgeoning relationship, as well as all of these scenarios over the course of the week. The BBC's Jonathan Frewin, keeping us in the loop as always. Jonathan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. The Arizona wine industry has been steadily growing for the last two decades or so near the Verde Valley east of Sedona, as well as in the Sky Islands of Willcox and Sonoyta in the southern part of the state. But today, they're facing the same threat that most of the world's winemaking regions are staring down: climate change.
And for one of the earliest trailblazers in the industry here, the challenge is the whole point. Todd Bostock is the owner of Dos Cabezas Wineworks in Sonoyta, and he told our co-host Lauren Gilger it holds true to its nickname, the Wild West of the wine world.
Yeah, I think it is, and I think that's part of what makes it exciting. You know, I grew up here, and the idea that you could be a part of a place figuring out what it tastes like, I think, is a rare and unique opportunity in the world. So yeah, it's challenging, but I think that's the whole point, right, is that it's distinctive, it's adding to the conversation. It brings something new to the table.
Yeah. Okay. So we have seen climate change really impact us a lot in Arizona. A lot of people will say we're on the front lines of climate change, right? We're seeing these record high summers. We're seeing record dry winters. You're not here in the valley, but how is climate change affecting what you're trying to do there? The grapes are temperamental, right?
Yeah. Things are different, even in my short lifetime. You know, hail used to be a rare occurrence, and now it seems to be a regular occurrence. The vineyard we farm in Elgin, you know, 5 out of the last 10 years, we didn't have a crop to make wine from. And I think folks would assume it's because of, you know, it's too hot or too dry. But typically it's cold and wet. So late spring frost, early fall frost, extreme cold, hail. Those are the issues we deal with. And they seem to be more frequent. And I don't think we're alone there. I think you see folks around the world, you know, using things like hail netting is becoming a more common necessity in the vineyard.
And wow.
So, yeah, it's happening.
Is it getting less predictable? That tends to be one of the hallmarks of climate change in Arizona.
You know, I think it is. Part of what makes what we do kind of possible is the monsoon. And we complain about it because it brings water in the middle of ripening season, which can be challenging to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
But it also slows things down. And it's become seemingly more unpredictable. You know, I think the last 2 years, we didn't have much of it at all. And it compressed our season. And we were bringing in, you know, where we're used to bringing in fruit over the course of, say, 2 months, we were bringing it in, you know, over the course of a couple of weeks. I think we picked for 2 weeks straight last year, which usually, you know, we can count on some days off.
So everything ripens at once and earlier, it sounds like.
Yeah, that seems like the trend, especially without monsoons. And so what we have to do is learn how to adapt so that we can hedge our bets and continue to do what we do. And so we can, you know, look at what folks in California and in Europe are doing. But, you know, when they talk about some of the farming practices they're putting into place, that doesn't necessarily work here. You know, a good example is folks talking about increasing biodiversity in the vineyard,
right,
making a more durable farm. But if you're talking about grazing animals, if you have no rain during the off season, what are your animals going to graze on? But that's one of the challenges. That's the whole point. I mean, if we wanted this to be easier, we could have done it any place where they've already figured out a lot of the big things in there. You know, we're trying to figure out how to adapt as we're also creating the legal framework to exist in Arizona,
yeah,
and creating the market for the wine, in addition to dealing with this problem.
Yeah. Let me ask you about the implications of this, like the impact of all of this on you. You said 5 out of the last 10 seasons, one of your vineyards has had no grapes you can use. Like, what does this do to the business?
Yeah, it's challenging. You know, so for what it's worth, we're looking at redeveloping that vineyard so that we can learn some things and diversify so that if a grape crop does get wiped out, we still have some income.
Yeah.
From our activity for the year. So we have to be flexible and try to become, you know, very durable so we can survive.
Durable and flexible, absolutely. There's also the issue of water in rural Arizona, right? Like, groundwater is dwindling in many places. There's often no regulation on who can pump and how much they can pump in many areas. There is regulation in your area where you are. What do you think you would like to see on that front as somebody involved in agriculture here and as this kind of policy debate over how we regulate groundwater in Arizona rages on?
Yeah. So without dissing any of our agricultural neighbors and just talking about us, you know, I think mm-hmm. grapes are a great crop for Arizona because they're low water use and they're high value. And so it's very rare, I think, that you see anymore where the community realizes the value of the water pumped out of the ground. And with grapevines, you see that because it gets turned into wine in the community. People come and spend the night. They eat at restaurants. They fill their cars up with gas in the community that gave up the water, where some of the other larger commodity crops, those products are shipped far, far away, and the true value of the water pumped is realized outside the community. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not a policy guy. There are people that are way smarter than us that can figure this out, but there has to be some way that water can be managed and allocated so that it's there for a long period of time and that it benefits the community. You know, we've done some things in Wilcox where our irrigation is subterranean, so we've got subterranean drip irrigation, so the water's being, you know, metered out in the ground mm-hmm. near the root system to minimize evaporation and loss. And, you know, I think there's other things that our industry can do to create value for the community of the water that gets pumped out of the ground.
Are you mostly relying on groundwater or is this, can you capture rainwater? Can you use other sources?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we can do more to increase our water holding capacity. That being said, I don't think at this point we could survive without irrigation, but we are able to create a lot of value for the limited amount of water that we pump out of the ground compared to some other crops.
Okay, so we talked a lot about the challenges involved in trying to grow grapes in a climate-changed Arizona, right? But it sounds like you also really see this as an opportunity, which is sort of counterintuitive here. You do what's called regenerative agriculture, right? Like, what does this look like on your farm?
We're working towards it.
Sure.
And so, but we see tools like that as the future. And, you know, the whole goal for us, it's all in service of making bottles of wine that taste great.
Yeah.
But if we can do these other things and do a better job and do a better job with the resources we have, then I think that's a good thing. I mean, it's going to be a necessary thing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think that that's a great toolkit. And then, you know, I think on the wine side, we now make a sparkling wine that we use a perpetual cuvée system, which allows you to kind of smooth out the vintages. So we're going to release a wine. It's called Tigresa, and it's 95% perpetual cuvée, which means there's wine in it from 2015 all the way through 2020.
Huh.
And it allows us to take those extremes and smooth them out and make something that tastes delicious and kind of consistent.
So you're regulating it on the back end.
Yeah, I think we have to do. Creative. I think we have to be creative from all angles.
Yeah. So one of the things that strikes me as difficult about this, right, is that it comes at a time when the Arizona wine industry is really blossoming and has been growing for, you know, a couple of decades here. You've been a big part of that. Does it feel like it's frustrating to kind of get to this moment in making wine in Arizona and making it something that, as you said, like, tastes like this place and then get hit with all of these curveballs.
Maybe like for the first, maybe the first year when we were so green, we didn't expect to take those punches.
But yeah,
I'd like to think that we've toughened up a bit, and it's part of the challenge. I mean, it's part of why we do it. And yeah. So, yeah, I mean, I think we saw during COVID, especially in our county, in Santa Cruz County, that our industry was one of the few, maybe the only one, that actually grew during that time. And so there's enormous opportunity, but I think it'll be naturally limited, which I don't know is such a bad thing.
Really? Why not?
I mean, I think if you look at what's going on in wine in the U.S., you know, you see what's coming down from the FDA, you know, talk about like warning labels, talk about younger folks aren't drinking wine.
Mm-hmm.
But the truth is, I think these are all things that keep an industry healthy, that it keeps people from getting complacent and pursuing quality and not just coasting.
Not just coasting. All right. Todd Bostock with Dos Cabezas Wineworks. Thank you so much. Appreciate it coming in.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Mark, did you ever see that Coen Brothers movie, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
A long time ago. I remember a lot of like old-timey type mustaches and bluegrass music, that kind of thing.
Yes, that's right. It was a very, I think it's fair to say, eccentric, character-driven movie. Mm. Had a very distinct tone, as you're alluding to. But I would argue also that the fact that you remember the tone at all is notable because, did you know, that movie was based on Homer's The Odyssey.
I did not know that.
See, this is the thing. O Brother, Where Art Thou is one of the rare Homer adaptations that connected with modern audiences. Because unless you were a classics major in college, most people view Homer's epic poems, the aforementioned Odyssey and the Iliad, more as academic curiosities rather than stirring works of drama. Dr. Emily Wilson has dedicated much of her adult life to changing that. Wilson is a professor at the University of Pennsylvania and a former MacArthur Genius Grant recipient for her work retranslating Homer. For the Iliad alone, Wilson spent 6 years with the original Greek text in an attempt to create a version that channels the emotional intensity and narrative urgency of the original. Wilson will be giving the ASU Humanities Institute's distinguished lecture tomorrow night, and when I spoke with her recently, she told me that she has loved Homer since she first read his work in high school.
I remember just being astonished by the representations of the gods. The omnipresence of the gods in the world of the Iliad, I think, is extraordinary, combined with the omnipresence of mortality on the human realm.
Interesting. So there was something eternal and finite present in the text, if I'm hearing you correctly.
Yes, yeah. Both eternal and finite, and a kind of sublimity that's also constantly grounded in a very real feeling material world, and also grounded in very intense emotions.
Yes. Well, I'm curious to know, not to tarry too long in high school, but I am curious about this moment because something that you have been so lauded for in your work on these texts is your ability to enliven them, to give them a life in recitation or oratory that really lands with people, and that they don't just feel like these dry old classical kind of museum pieces. What was it about the versions that you read at that time that did that for you, since, you know, you weren't reading your own retranslations?
I was reading the Greek. I mean, so I started studying ancient Greek in high school, and it was the Greek text that was magical for me. So I imprinted not on a particular translation, but on the music and rhythm and sublimity of the original, the sounds of the original Greek.
Okay. Well, so that gets me to the effort that you have made to try to honor what you've called the oral heritage of these works with a regular and audible rhythm and with a language that would invite reading out loud and come to life in the mouth, is what you've said. In sitting down to confront that challenge, how did you begin to do that? Like, which of those imperatives came first?
When I was first asked to consider doing a retranslation, I spent a lot of time just reflecting on my many decades of teaching these texts to undergraduates. And I just meditated on what have I not been able to get across. And to me, the hugest loss in all of the translations that I'd used was that none of them have a regular meter. Part of my training has been not just as a classicist focused on ancient Greek and Latin verse, but also on especially early modern English metrical verse, Milton and Shakespeare, that era of Anglophone poetry. And I didn't realize at the time, you know, when I was obsessively reading Paradise Lost and Shakespeare, that was in a way training for trying to create an epic poem in English, without necessarily making it seem sort of retro in ways that were fake, but making it seem traditional, but also alive, full of energy, full of emotions.
Could I ask you for a favorite line, either from your version of the Odyssey or of the Iliad, that you feel really accomplishes this or illustrates this?
I can just do the beginning of the Iliad.
That would be wonderful.
All right, so this is the proem of the Iliad, which is, of course, is in dactylic hexameter, the meter used in throughout in both Homeric poems. Meninaida thea, peleado akileos, ulamenen, hermuria kaios algeatheca, polas diphthimus psukasa idi proiapsin, hero on, autuste heluria chukekunesin. And then I'll do my translation. Goddess, sing of the cataclysmic wrath of great Achilles, son of Peleus, that caused the Greeks immeasurable pain and sent so many noble souls of heroes to Hades and made men the spoils of dogs, a banquet for the birds. And so the plan of Zeus unfolded.
Thank you very much, Dr. Wilson. That was such a wonderful illustration of what you're talking about. I mean, the way that the syllables on the line landed on just the word cataclysmic. And the way that then there was a part where you said son of somebody, that part of the line is sort of tucked in the delivery and renders it more like informational rather than giving it the same weight as the other parts of that line. Something that small to me already makes the text feel so much more alive.
Interesting. Yes. I mean, so Homeric poetry has these formulaic elements, including formulaic patronymics as well as epithets. So, of course, Achilles is repeatedly son of Peleus, son of Peleus. And on some level, those things are tucked in. I mean, they're there repeatedly and over. They don't have the same kind of weight as the multisyllabic and also unusual term, ulomenen, which in the original has an enjambment. I wanted to get something of the energy of that. There's something extraordinary about this superhuman, quasi-divine kind of wrath. It is cataclysmic wrath. It's not regular human anger.
Yes. Okay, well, so help me make the connection between that and the fact that, as you have also pointed out, there are some things that inevitably are going to be lost when a translation takes place. There's just some essential context in the Greek that there's a gap there between that and present-day English that can't be achieved. How would you characterize what it is that's lost, and do you feel like there's anything new that emerges when you put it in English?
Yes, thank you for that question. I mean, I think it's important for any translator or any reader of translations to understand that a translation is always a completely different thing from the original. One of the hugest challenges is that the Homeric poems were based on centuries of pre-existing oral tradition. They were composed using this new technology, new in the 7th century BCE, of writing, but drawing on many centuries when there was no writing in Greek. And so for a translator trying to think through, how do I create an equivalent experience? We can't make up a tradition from scratch that doesn't exist. We can't right. pretend. You know, for the last 200-300 years, there's been no writing in English. I am inevitably writing for a very literate readership.
Yeah. Well, in closing, Dr. Wilson, I wanted to ask, in an article from 2023, one of the things that you said that I found really compelling in the spirit of kind of where we began and the power of the gods. You said that you prayed to the muse of heroic poetry, Calliope, for aid. as you were creating your retranslations. Would you be willing to share anything about what was in those prayers and what you feel came of them?
I mean, translation is actually very hard to talk about. I'm constantly reaching for something which I don't know what the words are. And so that, in a way, is, to me, is inherently a quasi-spiritual quest. What's a little bit beyond what a mortal human being could do? And these epics, the Odyssey and the Iliad, are so consistently engaged with that question too, that question of what slippage might there be between mortals and immortals, and what would it be like to be the kind of mortal who could, even for a moment, have an encounter with the divine.
Wow. Well, Dr. Emily Wilson will be speaking about her work at the 2025 Humanities Institute Distinguished Lecture at ASU on March 25th. And she's also, of course, a professor at the University of Pennsylvania in the Department of Classical Studies. Dr. Wilson, thank you for this conversation.
Sure. Thank you so much.
And that'll do it for this Monday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, so much for being along. Hope you have a terrific rest of your day. For Sam Dingman and Lauren Gilger, I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow. That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.